portions of today's program are mechanically reproduced. And now keep your dial set on Channel 26 for the finest of television programming.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission.
Relief. You two take care of labor.
Only intended for a plane, Captain.
Danger! Danger! Man your stations! Vehicle in direct path of meteor storm!
You don't want to die of cold. Toll free.
Look! I'm a doctor, not an escalator. Spock, give me a hand.
I'll give you trouble!
Pop your piece around the track if you get
nails and more nails.
Have you ever tried to report a UFO sighting?
I'll save you the trouble. There is not a single government agency still in existence that will admit to any interest in the subject. If you seem to be insistent, they will refer you to a private organization.
You handsome, charming, specially marked boxes of monster cereals know. Inside one of these free wax lips, fangs, or mustaches, they just uncover the real you.
We now continue with Smurf.
Steve Austin, astronaut. A man barely alive.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man.
Baby, I'm your man.
In the California mountains, there's a colony of aliens, explorers from deep space. They also control the Sasquatch.
Bigfoot?
That's right.
All funky colors. Shapes that swing.
That's impossible.
Robots? I call them fembots. The perfect women. Programmable, obedient, and as beautiful or as deadly as I choose to make them.
Really? They're robots.
And now part two of Kill Oscar.
Run while you can, boss.
Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
Welcome to Season 6, a season we've been calling Two Old Farts Meet the Glass Teat. Thank you, Harlan Ellison, for the inspiration. Our love of genre really did begin with television. Before we were old enough to read or even go to the theater, there was the omnipresent boob tube spewing out stories in glorious black and white.
So this season, we're covering some of the shows that we loved from the era of the late 1960s to the early 1980s. Shows that had influence and are still well remembered by old farts like you and me, and hopefully by our listeners out there. Over the next two episodes, we'll be examining the bionic worlds of Colonel Steve Austin and Jamie Summers. And we'll have a little surprise for you, courtesy of friend of the show, Canadian sci-fi legend Robert J. Sawyer. We're extremely excited for this one.
We can honestly say the two of us have put in more man hours. Do people actually use man hours anymore? I guess
they people
do.
Hours?
People hours. We've put in more people hours on this show than any other. There was the bulk of 8 seasons of television to revisit, as well as 6 made-for-TV movies. Despite what it might seem like at times, we here at Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi do not just do wiki-based, half-assed internet research. We also went down a rabbit hole to give you as much background as possible.
In particular, I want to point fans who are looking for more $6 Million Man info to Herbie J. Pilato's The Bionic Book, as well as Cyborg, a bionic podcast, and the Bionic Blonde website. They were really so helpful in putting this show together. What was your viewing experience for the $6 Million Man like, David, like back in the day? Not this week, but back when you were a kid.
Well, back in the day, it was one of those shows that you watched every week. You knew when it was on. You glued yourself to the TV. You sat your ass in a chair and you watched and you felt like, what if I was Colonel Steve Austin? What if I could do miraculous things? And you're there watching the show, worried about if something's going to happen to him, enjoying the fact that he somehow comes out on top. It's almost like the old Batman series from the 60s where they get out of some issue and can resolve it. So there's that. The opening credits is the kind of thing where you don't skip over. You don't every time, like doing all these rewatches. I watch that opening every time because it's that great. And then the slow motion stuff, all the little bits, it all came back rewatching this show that we all loved in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess for me, I was in Willowdale, a northern suburb of Toronto. And I guess originally I probably would have been in grade three when the show first started to air. Now, I do remember like the Friday nights getting ready for it, but it's really the Sunday night that I recall most because it was like, you know, the last thing before I had to go to bed and the new school week began. And I would be one of those kids. I'd lie in front of the TV, assuming the position on my stomach. My knees would be bent and my feet would be facing the ceiling and my head would be resting in the palm of my hands. And this, by the way, is a position that I could never do in a million or 6 million years now. But it was just excitement time. Generally, it was if it was Sunday night, it was I think the lead in show was the Hardy Boys and the Nancy Drew Mysteries. And, you know, I was okay with that. But really, it felt like an opening band for me getting ready for the $6 Million Man. And yeah, then just the next day we'd be like talking about whatever the previous episode was, because generally they were good episodes. Now we need to touch on a little bit of the fashion of the show and like the impact that the fashion had, I guess, on us. So we always see Lee in the early days in a leisure suit. Did you have a Lee Majors, Steve Austin inspired leisure suit, Dave, or anything like that?
No, I somehow skipped the leisure suit era. So I did not, dress as my hero.
Well, it's cool because it's the one that you could get away with, right? You couldn't go to school dressed as Batman, but you could sort of like go in and you're in your $6 million man leisure suit. And, you know, only the hip kids knew what you were doing. Yeah, I had one. It was light blue and it was one of my favorite pieces of clothing ever. And I think I have a picture of me in my grade four class picture wearing it. So at some point I'll try to remember to post that on the Facebook page. Once I started in on the rewatch doing the deep dive, I couldn't help but notice how often Steve Austin wears shirts or jackets with those little button down shoulder epaulets. And, it's like, it's there constantly. It's even in the last episode. In season five. So like, despite all the changes the show goes through, he sticks to the epaulettes. And I wonder if that was just something Lee Majors liked, or if it was like, because epaulettes are kind of a throwback to military styling. So as Colonel Austin, I don't know if they were going for that, or if Lee Majors just liked it. He also had a recurring belt buckle that looked like two uppercase M's lying on their sides. Did you have any other sort of fashion comments for the show?
Just of its time, you know, you've got the fashion. So when you're watching this mid-70s show, you get that whole kind of style that just says, okay, this, you know, it's almost like Streets of San Francisco and other shows of its time that you just had a style. Like, you can almost set each show, whatever it is, in its era. It'd be hard to bring that, like, if they did, and this is weird, I think we'll talk about this later in the show probably, but the idea of bringing something like this back, I think there was a Bionic Woman series, yep, a few years ago, but to bring that back, it does have to represent the time. Otherwise, it would just look a bit odd if you have something that just doesn't look like everything else.
Yeah. I have a theory. It just occurred to me. So we've not discussed this, but we have talked about the fact that as the series goes on, Steve seems to lose a button with at least each year. So for most of the series, his shirt is unbuttoned to at least his sternum. And then as it gets later in the series, it's like down to like his navel until he actually loses it. But what my thought was that in those early seasons, especially season one and two, he's in a lot of turtlenecks. And I'm wondering if with all of the physical work that Lee Majors actually did on the show, if he kind of balked at the idea of wearing the turtlenecks, and then he was just so hot that it's like, you know what? I'm wearing shirts. I'm keeping it open because I'm boiling on set. I don't know if there's anything to that. I've never read it. Just a theory of mine. And then of course, you know, there's the iconic look of the show with the sound effects, but the slow motion, which they supposedly, now I've heard two stories on this. The one that stuck with me is that they took it from, I think Harv Bennett said that he always loved the look of those NFL films that used to get aired. And they would always, you know, they were shooting those things with film as opposed to most or all of NFL TV. It's video, you know, it's not shot on film. But when you saw those slow motion highlights of like Earl Campbell or Tony Dorsett or whatever running, it looks super cool. And Harv Bennett says that was the inspiration. I've heard somebody else say that actually they got it from Kung Fu, because Kung Fu did a little bit of slow-mo as well. So I don't think answers to these things need to be exclusive. I think, you know, you can have inspiration from different places, but anyway, that's what I've heard, and I'm sorry, I feel like I'm eating into our time here, but slow motion, were you one of those kids like I was that used to run around the play yard or whatever, the schoolyard, doing slow-mo running?
Yeah, and with my brothers, we would have these fights, like, in the backyard.
Oh, yes.
And it's all slow. So you do this fist punch, and it takes, like, 10 seconds. Yeah, exactly. As that fist gets closer and closer to the, and then you have to react. Like, if you're the one being punched in the stomach, you then move back.
Yeah.
In that same slow mo. Those fights took a while.
Yeah. I think I did it until it was replaced with the Starsky and Hutch sliding across the car hoods, which people liked a lot less. You would just like run at their car, the hood of their car, and slide it. Awesome.
Car hoods became a big thing, like even with T.J. Hooker. There's also an episode of Saturday Night Live where William Shatner is a guest host, and this whole skit is him on a car hood with a walkie-talkie in his hand, and then you actually get a season change. You got snow coming down. He's still on the car hood talking to whoever it is on the thing. It was such a wonderful, funny parody of riding on a car hood, for sure.
Yeah, I actually wondered today, too, if, you know, how teachers used to yell at you, like, you know, don't run in the halls. I wonder if at some point for a brief period they would yell, don't run in slow motion in the halls.
I like that.
It's like, just get to the classroom, for God's sake. Stop running in slow motion. We have talked before about how iconic the opening credit segment of The $6 Million Man was.
Yeah, it may be one of the best ever. We had an episode that was aired in mid-September where we had guest Lee McCormick, who was there for our Galactic Rock three-part episode earlier. But he's our guest talking about themes, and certainly the $6 Million Man theme and just the opening. Sometimes you can't separate them.
Yeah, that's just one of the best. It really is one of the best ever. Like, it still stands up today. You watch it now and you feel the same way you did.
Mentioned too, like, the, I mean, every time, and this has been going on for 50 years, every time you hear it, that line, "A man barely alive," your hair goes up on the back of your neck, on your arms, still to this day.
I mean, well, you just said it, and the hair went up on my arms. You know, like, that's how good it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Should we get into some of the history? The $6 Million Man began life as Cyborg, the 1972 novel by Martin Caden. Caden was a prolific writer of sci-fi and military history. He brought these two loves together, as well as his experience as a pilot, to create Colonel Steve Austin. Caden claims that the military had long been interested in developing a bionics program. It was the author's ambition to portray all of this as realistically as possible.
In fact, the crafts that we would see every week during the opening credits of $6 Million Man was not just based on the actual crash of NASA test pilot Bruce Peterson. The opening included actual cockpit footage. Universal Studios had picked up the rights for Caden's novel Cyborg. Plans were put in motion to create a made-for-TV movie for ABC.
Lee Majors was cast in the role of Steve Austin, the man who would become the cyborg for the government agency OSO, although that name would change. Originally, Oliver Spencer, the head of the OSO, was played by Night Stalker-to-be Darren McGavin, while the surgeon who would save Colonel Austin, Rudy Wells, was played by acting legend Martin Balsam. Now, let's address this right now. There have been three Rudy Wells: Martin Balsam in the original pilot, Alan Oppenheimer in the second and third pilot episodes, as well as in seasons one and two of $6 Million Man, and one episode in season three. And then finally, we get Martin E. Brooks, who plays Rudy for the remainder of $6 Million Man and the entirety of The Bionic Woman.
The original TV film was a huge success for ABC, and two other movies of the week were ordered. These films were The Solid Gold Kidnapping and Wine, Women, and War. These two programs were produced by Glenn Larson. They suffered from being a pastiche of James Bond. This Steve Austin dressed in a tux. He was a lover with a license to kill. Far from the Colonel Steve Austin the world would come to love. Here's a sample of the Bondian theme song that was performed by Dusty Springfield.
We have the technology to rebuild him. I want it done no matter what the cost.
He's the man.
$6 Million Man.
He's the man.
$6 Million Man.
Catch him if you can.
Beat him if you can.
Love him if you can. Now he's the man.
$6 Million.
Martin Caden was furious. He said, "I wanted my name off the credits. They didn't need that Bond shit. They were ridiculous from a technical standpoint and had nothing to do with reality. Larson is a very successful producer, but we didn't get along. When he turned it into a Bond thing, I raised holy hell." Despite the fact that changes would have to be made, ABC knew they had the makings of a hit series on their hands. Harv Bennett was brought in to make those changes.
We need to talk a bit about producer Harv Bennett, the man who ultimately was responsible for the show we came to love. Bennett had produced The Mod Squad for ABC and would later go on to head up production on the Star Trek films 2 to 5. the great thing about Harve Bennett was that he got the character. Bennett's cyborg would never be a RoboCop for the OSI. He understood that Steve Austin's humanity was essential. I'm not a freak. I'm a human being. That's the cry of Steve Austin, Bennett said. That's what subconsciously drew me to the $6 million man.
But Bennett had just 6 weeks to create the new series for ABC before it was due to air. He said, "We returned Lee to the monosyllabic, shy with the ladies, aw shucks kind of Western man amidst all of this technology, which he used well. Lee portrayed that wonderfully." Filling out the cast of regulars was Richard Anderson, who played Oscar Goldman, the head of the rechristened OSI, while Alan Oppenheimer stepped in as Dr. Rudy Wells.
The $6 Million Man ran on ABC from March 7th, 1973, till March 6th, 1978. The run consisted of 5 seasons, 102 episodes. It was bookended by 2 sets of 3 TV movies. The show would become a staple of Sunday night viewing, but originally aired on Fridays, paired with either Kung Fu or Happy Days. Now, that's a pairing. What would you like with your Kung Fu, sir? Oh, I'd like the $6 million man, please.
And some wontons.
And some wontons. Yeah. Yeah. The series helped to put ABC at the top of the ratings for the first time in the history of the network.
By season 3 of $6 Million Man, it had given us the spin-off The Bionic Woman, starring Lindsay Wagner. That show was also a hit. It aired on ABC and later NBC. The Bionic Woman ran between January 1976 and May 1978, 3 seasons consisting of 58 episodes. And there is a very brief account of the early days of the $6 Million Man. Now, Dave, why don't we talk a little bit about the original pilot, which was directed by Richard Irving and written by Howard Rodman and Stephen Bochco. Yes, that's Stephen Bochco. Do you remember seeing it when it originally aired in 1973?
I can't even remember. 73, I would have been 11 years old, but it's quite possible, because we were watching a fair amount of TV back in the day, that it could have been, and we were always very much into the movies. And, you know, once you've got your movies and you've got the actual series starting, I think I did see it, like some of the memories of what he was going through. You know, it's, he's given all of this, but they throw him in the toughest thing just to see if he'll survive. It's just, you know, you have to want to live after an accident like that. Otherwise, that's a problem. So I think it was very strong, very well done. It was very powerful, and it really got you into the character and how things work. So I think as a pilot, it was very successful.
Yeah, they did do a really great job with it. I remember seeing promos for it on ABC, and I was really, really stoked for it. For some reason, I recall thinking that Steve's accident was going to happen on the moon. I think there was something about the way the promos were shot that, anyway, it had me excited for that. But, you know, perhaps it was because I knew the character was an astronaut. Maybe it was that it was a marriage of 2 things that I really liked at the time, real life NASA stories and superheroes. But there were no capes, no masks with $6 Million Man, which made it even cooler. The pilot, the show, not the test pilot, the pilot has a great opening and introduction to Steve Austin. Like you said, he's not a colonel in the pilot. And what I'm thinking of is we see Steve walking onto the runway from the desert in a very biblical, it's a very biblical mythic thing to do, that imagery. It's a very Joseph Campbell way to introduce your hero. Darren McGavin's Oliver Spencer is much colder and menacing than Oscar Goldman, the Oscar Goldman that we'd eventually get anyway. And I can't even imagine Oliver Spencer ever calling Steve pal the way Oscar does.
Absolutely. And we may get into a drinking game later. because maybe we'll have to add anytime that Oscar Goldman calls Steve Austin pal.
Yeah.
Would be one of those things, but maybe we'll get into that later.
Or so Jamie Summers, or Jamie Summers' babe, which is really almost uncomfortable now to watch.
Wow. Yeah. So, it's certainly of its time. In the pilot, we get the famous crash scene where Steve is on the brink of death and Oscar orders Rudy to implant the new bionic limbs, an eye that will make Steve a cyborg, basically part human, part robot. Afterwards, Steve struggles with what's been done to him and what he's become.
The thing is, Doc, why? Why?
Why what?
Oh, come on. I may walk like a 2-year-old, but I'm not that naive. Now, you all have given me a gift, and I thank you very much. But now, what is the price tag?
We have given you something back that you've lost, and that is all.
How do you know what I've lost?
We've given you an eye for an eye, haven't we? An arm for an arm?
My arm didn't come packed in a wooden box.
What do you want?
I want to know who's paying the freight.
What's the difference?
The difference is when the bill comes due.
What are you so suspicious of?
Look, I was a civilian member of the space program for 12 years. I know how much things cost. Now, why am I worth a few million dollars? And what do I have to do for it?
How can I communicate with you when you suspect everything that I say?
When I was up there on the moon, Doc, I was a quarter of a million miles away from the real world. But I felt a lot closer to it then than I do now.
Lee Majors really creates the template for his character. After the crash, Steve's vulnerability is never far from the surface. He's never verbose, but Majors conveys a lot here and throughout the series with just a look.
Steve is later sent out on his first OSO mission in the Middle East. And Steve doesn't pussyfoot around when push comes to shove. He's tossing grenades and mowing down baddies left, right, and center. That type of thing would change once the series went to air. In the final scene, we have, after Steve's mission, the pilot wraps up with Rudy doing work on Steve's bionics. And we get an exchange of some harsh words between Oliver Spencer and Steve. Oliver then asks Rudy if they can basically keep Steve medically asleep until needed for his next mission, to which Rudy balks. Any general impressions of the way things wrap up in the pilot, Dave?
Well, it certainly wraps up the tension a bit. And you're just wondering, how is he going to survive? What is he going to do? There's this sense that he owes the OSO, or eventually OSI, that, you know, they spent all this money on him, they fixed him up, but he then has to do work for them. And there's also the uncomfortable relationship between him and the, the Oscar Goldman, or in this case, Oliver Spencer at the time role. And to just see that this is tension, this is what you want in a series. You don't want everyone to be just all happy-go-lucky and things all going in. You have to throw obstacles. You have to throw issues. You have to. And the whole thing with Steve standing up for his own humanity is such an important aspect. And you can really sense the emotion and the feeling and how he feels about what's happened to him. And that's just something that was, I think, very key in that pilot.
Yeah. And actually, now that I think of it, it's one of the really cool things about the early era of the $6 Million Man and later the Bionic Woman, in which your heroes, this is not like being Superman or Batman, where these characters choose to be this hero. We have people who didn't have a choice in becoming super, you know, of having these abilities. And as a result, they're beholden to this organization. It's like, well, you could either be a paraplegic for the rest of your life, you know, but no, we've given you these things, but you now have to go out and work for us. You know, it's almost like you have to work off the $6 million. So that's something that I had never seen before. And that also creates this dynamic that allows for the growth of the character. You know, where at first they don't want to be doing this. They don't even want to have the bionics, but they grow into their role.
Yeah, even understand more about who they are as people. One thing that just struck me while talking to you right now, I haven't even prepped or done anything about this, is the idea if they ever brought this whole sequence, this whole series back again, both of them. It would be wonderful if it turns out Jamie Summers was the astronaut that actually has that accident, and it's Steve Austin who has a parachute incident. But I'm sorry, I just thought that's a bit of a very
I like it.
Way of looking at
and,
it.
And it could actually, you could actually spin it as the $6 million woman and the bionic man.
Oh, wow. You know? Love it.
Just flip it.
Yeah.
That pilot certainly does whet the appetite for more. Let's move on to one of my favorite episodes. And I think one that it would be on a lot of people's lists, but it's Day of the Robot. And Day of the Robot was the fourth episode of season one of the new series. It aired on Friday, February 8th, 1974, and it starred John Saxon as Major Sloan, an old friend of Steve's, who is delivering an anti-missile activator to the military. And unbeknownst to anyone, an evil scientist played by Henry Jones has created an identical robot of Sloan. The plan is to replace the real Sloan with the robot and steal the activator. And this totally appealed to, you know, me as a little kid, I gotta say. Saxon does a fabulous job with his portrayal of his human character. And his stony robotic version is also great. Do you have any thoughts on Saxon in this part?
Yeah, well, I think we're both fans of John Saxon and the various things that he's been in. He's just one of our favorite actors. And thanks for inviting me up to your place so we could do a whole day of viewing various $6 Million Man episodes. And this, of course, had to be one of them. This really shows the dynamics, the ability, how good an actor John Saxon is, or it certainly was at that time. Mm-hmm. It's such a tour de force for him. It's just done so well that I just believe every moment of it, even and how he changes. Like it's like a personality change. Him as the robot, it's just night and day. It's just a different. It's still him, but different. And the way he pulls that off consistently through the episode, that I definitely became even more of a fan rewatching. I would have watched this back in the day, but rewatching it again with you a couple of weeks ago, it's just really. This is a wonderful piece that John Saxon delivers to us.
Yeah, he's so lifeless and frightening when it's the robot version of him.
You sure you're up to driving?
Yes, I feel fine now.
What was the name of that gal you were chasing after the last time I saw you? She was an airline stewardess, wasn't she?
Last time I saw you, I was chasing after a beauty named Clarissa. She's an artist.
That's right. Have you seen her lately?
No.
What's Mary doing these days?
She's still editing that woman's magazine.
Hey, you never told me. What do you think of Oscar Goldman?
Oscar Goldman? He seems a nice enough sort of guy. Efficient, dependable. Always on top of things. Not the sort of guy who'd leave you hanging.
Guess what, Fred?
What?
There's a car following us.
You weren't so nervous in the old days, Steve.
There's a car following us.
You weren't so nervous in the old...
This is the episode that locked me in as a regular viewer to the show. You know, I was there every week until Steve's mustache arrives in season four.
Wow. This fight is a part of TV history. It's played in slow-mo, the fight between robot and cyborg. It lasts for over 6 minutes. It was the first time we heard the bionic sound. It's used as robot Sloan's sound, not Steve's. Following this episode, the producers would incorporate it when Steve throws a punch. This is the first time on the show that we have a robot's faceplate fly off when struck. Now, what is it with robots and faceplates? Well, we'll get into that a bit later, because that's another maybe drinking. Oh, a robot's faceplate has come off. Slurp.
Yeah. Pal.
This would pal. Yeah, what's happened with your faceplate, pal?
Yeah.
I'll take off my glasses.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Then,
yeah. So anyways.
That'd be great. That'd be great if in Kill Oscar, when we're going to get into that I guess next episode, but in Kill Oscar, there's a robotic version of him. And imagine the robot takes the glasses off, but it also knocks the faceplate off.
So this would happen repeatedly in later Fembot episodes, as you say.
And it wasn't really original. I mean, I didn't know that as a kid. As kids, we were all like, gasp, you know, when the faceplates would come off. But so in Michael Crichton's film Westworld, it has a crazed killer robot played by Yul Brynner that loses its faceplate, exposing the circuitry behind it. And the 1959 Twilight Zone episode, The Lonely, also does something similar at the end of the episode.
Yeah, there's something about faceplates, certainly. So according to the episode's director, Les Martinson, the episode got the highest ratings of the season. For years, people recognized Saxon as, air quote, that robot from $6 Million Man, end air quote, despite having appeared in countless other shows and film. Can you imagine, you've done all these movies and everything else, people see you on the street, hey, I loved you in $6 Million Man.
yeah as the robot.
So let's move on to The Rescue of Athena 1, which aired March 15th, 1974. It was written by D.C. Fontana and featured Farrah Fawcett Majors.
I love this episode for a number of reasons. I love when Steve Austin gets to return to his astronaut roots. Farrah Fawcett appeared once a season for the first 4 years until she and Lee Majors divorced. And getting to see her featured in this pre-Charlie Angels role is a treat. And as a kid, I ate up, again, anything NASA. And there's so much NASA footage in this episode and Space Lab. I'd forgotten all about Space Lab until rewatching this episode.
Writer D.C. Fontana of Star Trek fame said, in quotes, NASA was so desperate for any kind of publicity at all that when asked if there was a chance of pulling some footage, they said, here's the library. Have whatever you want. We actually shot in the training capsule. And then they said, do you want to come to Houston and shoot in the Skylab mock-up? We couldn't afford that, so we made our own.
That's nice being able to make your own Skylab. I'd like to do that in the backyard. I don't think that would pass zoning laws, but whatever. In this episode, Farrah Fawcett Majors plays the first female astronaut. She's been trained by Steve, and when problems arise in space, Steve is forced to return to space to rescue his colleagues. The only real problem is that Steve doesn't realize that space radiation is causing his bionics to malfunction. So Farrah's character is forced to rise to the occasion and return their capsule to Earth. It's not Apollo 13, but I'm just as likely to rewatch this episode as that film.
Yeah, this episode really holds up. How Steve interacts with Farrah Fawcett Majors, you know, the role that she's playing. I can't remember if we mentioned her actual name.
Kellywood.
Of course, yeah. So when Steve Austin is training Kellywood, he's very hard-nosed and it's very tough. Mm-hmm. And you almost think, is this an issue? Is he just have generally just issues with other people, just generally, like anyone that he tries to train or women or whatever, like what have you? But he does at some point in the episode just say, you know, I'm very, very tough, but, you know, this is space for God's sake. Or maybe that's paraphrasing, but he is being very tough. But you can see his warmer and his nicer side, like as they're on the ship and trying to do the rescue and all of that stuff. You can really sense that that was why he was doing this training. I get a sense of this also from a more recent series called For All Mankind, where you do have the training is important and it's very tough and you have to go through this. I think Farrah Fawcett Majors is very strong in this role and it's very well written. It's one of the highlights, I think, for the season.
Yeah. And I do think it's my favorite of her appearances. Clearly, you know, there's a chemistry there, but I will say really quickly, and we're going to get into this later, it is striking how good the chemistry is between Lindsay Wagner and Lee Majors. Like, it works really well, but we're not there yet. But I do find it funny that as strong as Lee and Farrah's chemistry is in this episode, it's at least as strong later on with Steve and Jamie, as I will call them, Shamey, not Shamey. Steamy. 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 Shamey is from another show, which I'm not going to reference because I've referenced that show too many times recently. And I'll let you people figure out what that one is.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state. Then nearly 14 billion years ago, expansion started. Wait.
We certainly ask a lot of our audience. So.
That's right.
And that's our test question. So season two, there were a number of notable episodes in season two of the series. There was $7 Million Man, in which Steve learns he was not the only bionic man created by the OSI. There was Straight On Till Morning, the second script written by DC Fontana. There was The Peeping Blonde that featured Farrah Fawcett Majors' return to the show. And there was a fabulous episode, The Last Kamikaze.
Lee Majors had been suggesting that the writers create a love interest for Steve. Writer Kenneth Johnson approached Harv Bennett with an idea. Quote, I suggested we do The Bride of Frankenstein. You have this male cyborg. Shouldn't the logical extension be a female counterpart? That idea paid off big time for all involved.
The most notable episodes of the entire series aired in March of 1975 when Steve Austin takes a little R&R and heads home to Ojai, California, and he meets up with his sweetheart, Jamie Summers, played by the sublimely wonderful Lindsay Wagner.
Let's underscore for folks, without a word of hyperbole, exaggeration, or tall tale telling, that the romance between Steve Austin and Jamie Summers, aka the $6 million man and the bionic woman, is the greatest love story ever told. I may even put it ahead of John and Yoko, Paul and Linda, and Romeo and Juliet.
And I'm glad you brought in a little Beatles
little one
into this episode. Just a little one. How can you beat true love? You can't. Love is, for me, the most powerful thing in the universe beyond certain bionic legs for kicking down doors. So as the iconic episode unfolds, we witness Steve and Jamie falling in love, and we are treated to a montage of love that is accompanied by Lee Majors as Steve Austin confessing his love for Jamie in song.
Mm-hmm. It's been fun, lots of laughs, Jamie. It always is when friends meet again. But lately, it's gone flat for me, Jamie. I don't like seeing you now and then. Our friendship is finished, that's true. But there's hope, a way to make it through. Because, sweet Jamie, I love you. I never want to say goodbye to you. Sweet Jamie, I'll love you forever. I know we'll never part. I love you like I've loved no other. Make room for me in your heart.
so good, isn't it, Steve?
It's almost as good as my mom's.
Not the pie, dummy, us.
And you know, if you don't tell Mom, I think it's even better.
Then our impetuous star-crossed lovers decide to marry. And to celebrate their impending union, Steve and Jamie, or as I said before, Steamy, if you will, go skydiving, as young lovers do. I mean, David, what could go wrong?
No, nothing. Nothing could go wrong. Let's just go skydiving a week before we're going to get married. Jamie suffers a parachute malfunction, causing her to plummet to the ground. And just like that, she's on the verge of death with two shattered legs, a destroyed arm, and a wonky ear. But Steve has an idea.
Oscar, I asked you up here to help me. Now, so far, all I've got is a handful of red tape. Now, there's a woman in there with no hearing in one ear, an arm and both legs crushed beyond repair, and you have the power to put her back together again just like you did me.
Bionic limbs cost millions of dollars, you understand? Millions of dollars. I gotta get Rudy Wells and a whole bionic team up here. How am I gonna justify the expense?
Well, how did you justify me?
That was different. There was a need.
But there still is, Oscar. I mean, you know how they're always looking for a new angle, new device. I mean, think of what an asset Jamie could be to us. And her cover as a tennis pro, I mean, it's perfect.
Steve.
I mean, there are places that she could get into that I could never get into. And she's got the head for it. She's well-adjusted. She's clever.
Steve, you're in love with her.
What's that got to do with it?
Everything. You'd sell your soul for her. You'd do anything. You'd commit yourself to her. But someday, I'm going to say, I need her. I'm going to need her for a job. And you know what you're going to do, pal? You're going to change your mind.
No, I won't change my mind, Oscar. I swear it.
Like Steve. Well, I like Steve, too. But sorry. Like Steve, Jamie is at first repulsed by the idea of her bionics, thinking she's a freak. And like Steve, she comes around and begins her physical rehabilitation that will serve her well as having a montage for her own credits once a series is greenlit.
This is true. That's handy when that happens.
Oh, yeah.
Jamie does well in her recovery. And as Oscar promised Steve, there would be strings attached to saving Jamie's life. So Oscar sends her out on an OSI mission with Steve. The two are forced to abort the mission when Jamie's bionics malfunction. Jamie's body begins rejecting her bionics, and she is hospitalized. And in a fit of pain and confusion, she escapes from the hospital into, yes, a dark and stormy night. She collapses in Steve's arms and is brought back to the hospital, where Rudy Wells saves her, and they live happily ever after. I mean, of course Rudy saves her, right, Dave?
Wrong.
Give her 2 cc's adrenaline. Drop the line voltage on the electroanesthetic.
She's still slipping, Rudy.
Respiration is only 2 per minute. She's fading.
Heart rate dropping rapidly. Blood pressure falling off, Rudy.
Got a massive cerebral hemorrhage.
No reaction from the adrenaline.
Respiration is still dropping.
The vital signs are going.
How's the line voltage?
It's off. If she could be conscious, she would be.
Pulse down to. I can't find it.
Thank you.
love you, Jamie. I've always loved you.
The death of Jamie Summers on The $6 Million Man was one of the most upsetting, moving episodes of television I've ever seen. It was up there with the death of Henry Blake on MASH, the Twin Peaks episode. With the Twin Peaks episode, it was episode 16, where Leland confesses to killing his daughter and dies in the arms of Agent Cooper. And as a kid, this floored me. I mean, I was 10. I didn't think that this could happen on TV, that they could kill a beloved character. Usually even villains lived on The $6 Million Man.
Yeah, viewers were devastated. And actually, it sort of emotionally affected me when I visited you and we watched this episode, because my wife had passed away just, a year and a half before.
Yeah.
And all that came back. So I'm there, basically, you rushing off to find a Kleenex box and me bawling my eyes out. So I can totally understand, especially with someone who has gone through it, that how the viewers reacted. ABC execs had wanted Lindsay's character to die a la Ally McGraw in Love Story. They were inundated with hate mail for killing the character. One count suggests the network received as many as 200,000 letters. Yes, a lot of viewers were angry. But damn, there were a lot of viewers. The Bionic Woman two-parter was the fourth highest rated program of 1975 and the highest rated $6 Million Man episode ever. It's too bad they killed Jamie.
It was really too bad, and we were never going to see her again. But that's the way the cookie crumbles. ABC 86, The Bionic Woman. So they were just going to have to live with it.
Or were they? That's the end of part one of our Bionic two-parter.
Come on back next time for the second half of this cyborg celebration.
I'm David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
And this has been Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.